Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You are listening to a talk from the Glasgow School of Social Work Research Seminar Series. 5th of November 2009, Professor David Donison, University of Glasgow.
I want to talk about the advocacy service. Some of you will be familiar with it, some of you won't. So just a brief description of that before I begin, so we're all starting from the same point. 4 years ago, almost exactly, there began in Scotland a unique service. I don't think it exists in this form anywhere else in the world, providing a right to free and independent advocacy for people who have mental illnesses or learning disabilities, whether they are subject to compulsion or not, whether they are in residential care or living out in the community. And that was provided for in the Mental Health Care and Treatment Scotland Act of 2003, 2 years earlier, which came into force 4 years back. This service was provided on terms which enabled the agencies offering it to extend it to other groups to meet other needs wherever they could get that funded. It's provided by voluntary agencies, local ones, and they are commissioned by the local authorities and the health authorities in their area, and funded with money that comes from the Scottish Central Government through the health boards and the local authorities. Quite important, I think, that you separate the funding from the commissioning. The history of this kind of work in many parts of the world has been that it tends to be brought under control by the authorities funding it. There is at least a gap between the funder, the central government, which has an interest in improving the services, and the bodies with direct responsibility for the frontline services that may find themselves under fire in the course of advocacy work. Much of the work is done by volunteers, recruited, briefly trained, coordinated and supported by paid staff. And that too is, I think, a kind of accident, which has proved very important. It gives them roots in the communities they serve, I think the general feeling in that movement is that the volunteers should have a continuing place within it. This is not a temporary necessity, though it was indeed a temporary necessity. If they had to provide a wall-to-wall service across Scotland at rather short notice, they could only do it with help from a lot of volunteers who were already doing the work for other bodies, Alzheimer's societies, MenCap, SANE, dealing with schizophrenics, various other groups in the mental health field, who were already providing some advocacy work and either had to set up new agencies specially for the advocacy or had to shed other work they did, because the point about independence of the service is that the agencies concerned are not allowed to do anything else but advocacy. So there should be no conflict of interest. They shouldn't end up advocating against themselves in some part of the work. Now, that briefly is what I'm going to be talking about. I have an agenda in wanting to come and talk to you, which I should make frankly clear. And to explain it, I need to explain how this book came to be written. I got rather accidentally involved in one of these advocacy agencies and was fairly soon approached by some of our advocates who, picking up, I guess I'd been some kind of former academic, said we need some further training and opportunities for professional development. Where can we get a course? And I went off all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed saying I'm sure I can find something, and came back pretty soon saying there's practically nothing anywhere in the UK, for the quite understandable reason, the reason why the Academy is always 10 years behind new developments in the field, which is that they can't run courses until the teachers and the students have at least a small shelf of books and papers to read, and the research and the writing has not yet been done. I'm here in the hope I can inspire and encourage some of you, staff and students of this school, to do some of the research and writing that would create the literature which would enable you to run courses. I think the courses should be run and will be best run in the groups which are doing the research and the writing. And this is your opportunity. But to make any progress on that, I have to convince you that this is both interesting and important as a field of work. And I'll do my best, but leave, I hope, plenty of time for discussion before we're through. To set the context a bit for the development of this service, Gillian called it a project rather than a service, which I think is in many ways appropriate. It's not like other services. I, having come back and explained why there were no courses, I said rather rashly, well, so how about we write our own book? And they responded marvellously. And for about 15 months, we had meetings, small groups of meetings across our fairly extensive territory, where they brought cases with the agreement, of course, of the clients. Sometimes the stories written by the clients themselves. I brought drafts, and which were freely and vigorously criticised, and brought them back revised, and we made a book out of it. I had, at the end of the day, to do most of the writing, and somebody has to take the blame for the errors that undoubtedly remain, so it does have my name on the front. But it is a collective project by a whole team of people, to whom I'm enormously grateful. It couldn't possibly have been done without them. I'll pass, it's one of my few remaining copies, I'll pass a copy of the book around, because since I don't have time to tell you a lot that's in it, if you take a brief flip through the pages, it will give you some idea what's in it, and do let me make sure I get it back at the end of the afternoon. This is my agenda. I should say royalties go to advocacy, not to me. So I'm quite aggressive about selling the book. The broader context that gave rise to advocacy, I think, needs to be understood. And very briefly, I'll say something about this. We have two chapters on that in the book. I think the story really begins with the takeover of many powers in governance of this country by the public service professions from the local gentry who for centuries had effectively governed Britain. That was beginning between the wars, the rise of the medical officer of health as an example. But it was really the creation of welfare states right across the Western world after the Second World War, that led to this huge rise in the public service professions and their powers. The doctors, the social workers, the nurses, the town planners, the housing managers, the teachers, one after another, have grown in numbers and in strength and have taken over much that was previously done by local gentry who set up the schools, the hospitals, chaired their committees, ran the poor law committees, the local parishes, the development trusts in cities and all the other things. Also were the magistrates, also commanded their people in time of war. Now, all of that structure kind of was largely replaced in terms of its powers by public service professions. And for a while, people who were dissatisfied with the services they received from this growing system were able to seek some help in gaining redress, getting a response from politicians, local councillors, MPs, from trade unions, their trade union officials, and sometimes from the mass media, writing to the newspapers, getting the press interested, and so on. But I think it emerged, particularly in the 70s and the 80s, as Britain began to become an increasingly unequal society, as trade unions shrank in strength and in membership as there emerged a strata of society increasingly excluded from opportunities available to those in the mainstream. The trade unions, the politicians and the media were in the main speaking for the people on the other side of the counter. The welfare state brought enormous advantages, particularly while full employment continued. But many of the class conflicts that used to burn between workers and their employers, between tenants and their landlords, shifted to the counters, the classrooms, the consulting rooms of the welfare state. And that became clearer as more people became, as I say, excluded from the support of trade unions. We have examples of the way in which trade unions tended to speak for the professions running the welfare state more effectively than for the users, at least the more excluded users, the more poverty-stricken users of their services. And lay advocacy, meaning not by lawyers, emerged. I suppose if you want to put a date on it, the founding of the Child Poverty Action Group in 1965 is a useful starting point, a body that is a pressure group, but also taking up individual cases and advocating on their behalf. Next year, Shelter followed with the same kind of functions. And then more and more, the group speaking for various branches of the women's movements, the group speaking for ethnic minorities, about race relations, the groups speaking for gays and lesbians and transsexuals, and the biggest area of all, the group speaking for people suffering particular diseases, who were offering both support, advice, advocacy on behalf of their members, were exerting pressure on the state to improve services for the people they were speaking for. Mental health and learning disabilities advocacy, this tended to come later. These were some of the most excluded citizens in our society, and it's not surprising that that kind of movement was slow to pick up and in support of these people. But it happened and became, particularly in the United States, parts of Scandinavia, quite a power in the land, but funded precariously from voluntary agencies, fundraising activities, and through agencies that often did something else besides their advocacy in order to pay the bills and keep going. Scotland did it differently. And if you want to know why, we got a chapter on that too, and I'll try to explain briefly later, but I don't want to stop on that at the moment. I want to say that this service is extending opportunistically. Of the agencies providing this advocacy in Scotland, most of them, I think, provide advocacy for at least some people in the area who really would be classified as frail and elderly, rather than having a mental health problem. Some are supporting cared for children, looked after children, cared for by the local authorities. Are supporting people on direct payments for social care. Are working with other groups. There's one, at least I know, advocating for survivors of sexual abuse. There's one, rather briefly, it may come back, was advocating for parents and carers of children with special educational needs. Most interestingly, just about now, there is developing in three different areas advocacy commissioned and funded by a voluntary body for its members, the Stroke Association, which is paying for advocacy for its members, people who've had strokes. So I believe the service will grow and continue to grow. I can't promise you that at a time of rather dire financial prospects and public services, who can predict what's going to happen? But I would assume we have to at least discuss the possibility that this will become a growth area affecting many other services. It's a kind of historical accident that it began with what the Act calls mental disorders. It won't stop there. Indeed, one of the key people in the story, a civil servant in the Scottish Office and Health Department, tried before the bill was drawn up, to persuade his colleagues in other departments of central government all to chip in to a budget that would provide advocacy for anybody in Scotland for dealing with any public service. You may think it unsurprising that they refused. But Hector Mackenzie's challenge has not gone away. It's still there. Now, let me pause also to say, in dealing with the context, a word about us, meaning the Academy. I believe that the academics in the fields that call themselves what? Social policy, urban studies, public policy, and related fields like social work, the medical schools and public health, nursing, town planning and housing, this whole array of the academic enterprises. We were ourselves very largely created by the growth of those public service professions. We earn our living by teaching the people who want to join them. We do the research that gets funded to support those services and to deal with the problems they're working on. And our default stance, as it were, our natural inclination when we research and write about public services and the professions that provide them is one of critical but friendly critical hopes that they will do better. We're critical, but from within the welfare state family to which we also belong. We are talking, after all, about our former students. We're talking about the people who may facilitate our research or prevent it, the people who may even fund it. We are cautious in our dealings with them, courteous. And I think this has made the Academy less than as alert as it should be to the power relationships that exist within public services, both between the public service professions and those who depend on them, and between different branches of the public service professions, the doctors and the nurses and the social workers and the social security officials and the housing officials and all the rest. There are power relationships between them as well. And if they don't work very well together, it's the client who suffers. We need to be more alert, and I want to say a bit more about the things we should be thinking about. The class conflicts I referred to that were kind of transferred to the counters of the welfare state frequently appear in the kind of anecdotage, the jokes that we're all familiar with if you've done any field work. I remember way back when I first came to be a full-time Glaswegian in 1980 doing work out on the housing schemes, and one of the questions you were asked was, and what would you call 1,000 dead housing officers? To which the dark reply, you may know, was a start. And the people who coined that one called the social security officials, upon whose benefits so many of them depended, the SS. And I recall, because in my previous job I met a lot of social security officers, that if asked by strangers in the pub how do you make your living, they would rather demurely say, I'm a civil servant. But there's more serious analysis behind this kind of observation. There is the inverse care law, which you'll be familiar with, I'm sure, which tells us that, starting in health, the poorer and the sicker a population is, the poorer the quality and the less the quantity of medical care it will tend to receive. The healthier groups get better treated. Now, there's nothing special about health in that respect, except that they identified the pattern, gave it a name, did some research on it, and are even trying to do something about it. There are inverse care laws in education. There are inverse care laws in transport and planning policies. There are inverse care laws of the same kind in our tax system, which takes proportionately more money from the poorest people than from the richest people. This is an example in every service of the way in which class conflict and power relations persist and need to be understood and dealt with, and part of what calls advocacy into being. a society that, that develops, as we have in these professions, a new major source of power in time, takes about a generation, in time generates countervailing powers, sources of influence, speaking for those who need to get a more humane, a more efficient, more accountable response from the professions or whatever power structure we're dealing with. Just as trade unions develop to do business with employers. So they've developed a whole variety of responses, which we have not, I think, put together and seen as a set of responses or strategies for dealing with essentially the same problem. The problem being how to make public service professions more accountable, more humane, more effective and efficient. Let me just remind you of a few of these, all well known to you, but we need to see them as part of a whole system of strategies that, that have grown up separately without people quite recognising that they're doing the same kind of job. First, there's, of course, markets and the profit motive, pushed forward most dramatically by Margaret Thatcher's governments, but carried further by Tony Blair and Gordon Brown now. All sorts of ways in which the profit motive has been brought to bear, competition, sometimes through contracting out of services, putting it out into the private sector, often within the public sector, tracing the flow of funds, putting price tags on work that isn't actually charged for, but needs to be accounted for, providing more information about which surgeon is most effective, least likely to kill his patients, which university department is most popular with its students, which school gets the best SATs test results, and so on and so on, and trying to extend choice to people. This is a market strategy. There is direct payments and individual budgets, which in this room people are very familiar with, which is the same kind of strategy, but the crucial difference that the state can assess needs and resources and decides who gets most help in gaining the services to which they should be entitled. But it's transformed life for many voluntary agencies, which used to sell their services to the commissioning bodies, the local authorities, now have to sell them to individual customers. It's a different world for them. And also in the commercial independent sector too, of course. There's various forms of consultation and participation, increasing stress laid on the need to consult the public, the communities in which you're operating. Recently, planners have been subject to stronger obligations to consult the communities and to get developers to show that they've done that before considering planning applications for new developments. There's all that area of trying to involve people, listen to people. That's going further than that. There's community-based forms of governance. Taking furthest probably in some housing associations and cooperatives where the tenants of the houses actually run the association, may own it, own the property. That's another strategy for making the professions who are, the housing managers now recruited and paid by the tenants, have a very direct accountability to the people they serve. There is human rights law. That may sound rather kind of ponderous, but it's becoming increasingly important and often remarkably effective. A brave prisoner supported by expert witnesses from the prison service brought slopping out to an end in jails throughout Britain using human rights law that has now been brought into Britain in the 98 Human Rights Act. That's another legal strategy for achieving some of the same objectives. There's always been pro bono work in some professions, people serving the neediest of their clients and customers without charging for our work. The lawyers have always done a bit of that and have now found through the law centres and legal advice centres a way of getting the state to fund that because serving people who are legally aided, they run services which may be entirely free for people who need their help. Other examples, TPAS, Tenants Participation Advisory Service, set up originally, I think, by progressive housing managers, particularly to help council tenants learn how to take over the housing they lived in and form housing associations for the purpose, but really coming from the public service profession involved, still staffed by people with that background. There's Planning Aid, a charity set up by qualified town planners who, in evenings and weekends, help people cope with the system they administer during their working week. It's an interesting example, and it poses questions about whether social workers, teachers, who knows, the police should be doing the same kind of thing for people trying to cope with their services. There are other things that you may find less attractive, like litigation by service users, siphoning millions of pounds out of the health services and the education services to recompense people who feel that they've been ill-treated and failed by those services, money that might have been spent on education or health care. The helplines for children and for other groups are another example. Now, there's that whole array to which advocacy is added as the kind of latest addition, in a way, in Scotland. And we should bear in mind that we're part of a much wider system, and advocates need to consider sometimes whether they should refer their clients to one of these other sources of help. Whether we should mobilise more help from those other strategies for the work we're doing. But let's come to the research questions, which you may want to explore if you get interested in this field. I think they boil down, for me, to three main questions that are interrelated, because you can't answer any of them without considering the other two. This is just my kind of concern about this field, and you may not share it. You may come from another set of values or another moral standpoint and want to raise other questions. As soon as you start asking questions for research, you are inevitably choosing a moral standpoint of some kind in picking what's important to you and what's less important that you're at least for the time being going to neglect. These are the things I think are important. Listen critically, not just to accept them. First, there's the inverse Carroll. And the questions should be asked of any of these strategies, not only about advocacy, but I want to focus on advocacy because that's my main concern. Is the development of advocacy going to reinforce inverse care patterns? Or is it going to help us break out of those and get more help to the people who most need it and now too often get least? Looking ahead, you know, in 10 years' time, will people be saying, if you want to get your mother into the best old people's home, your daughter into the best secondary school, you get yourself an advocate? Because, you know, if that's the kind of individual service that the advocates respond to, this may simply reinforce inverse care patterns. Because every time you get your place in the old people's home or in the school, you're excluding other less aggressive, active, well-informed users of those services from the same opportunities. That's the way it could go. It's not a scandal. I mean, that's the way most lawyers, accountants and surveyors and all sorts of professions normally operate. Till the NHS, that was the way the doctors operated. They served the people who could pay them. But that's the way it might go. My second question is the development of the service going to reinforce our relationship with public services and the professions providing them as customers, language often used now in the services and by those professions, or is it going to strengthen and develop our role as citizens with collective responsibilities and opportunities and a concern about the quality of service that everybody gets. If we only serve individual clients with one-off problems, and most of the advocacy is all, that the state pays for, I believe, is always going to be of that kind, but if we only do that, it may end up reinforcing this customer relationship and ethos that is already widespread and encouraged by our governments. There's some advantages to it. I don't want to, you know, just reject it. But there's also a citizen role. And if we only operate with individual advocates for individual clients, we help people cope a bit better with the existing systems. It's only as you get people together who have shared experiences of these services to talk to each other, to think of better ways of running the whole system, and to exert some pressure, because they're all taxpayers and voters on the power structure, that you may improve the system for everybody, including those who never heard of advocacy and never got any of the services that they should be entitled to. My third question is, will the development of advocacy or these other strategies reinforce our assumptions, very widespread in the language that those in power use in talking about the services, that social services are provided by expert professionals for individual users of the service. The user benefits from that, hopefully, and that's it. Or will they build our conviction that health and welfare and education and other good things that the welfare state is supposed to develop are co-produced by collaboration between the provider and the user of the service. And not only that, co-produced by different public service professions working together to help the users of the service. There's marvellous examples in the medical field and in the education field of books by people who've argued that these things have to be co-produced, and the student and the patient are as important in achieving learning or health as the professionals who try to help them. There are people who have recognised that none of these things are carried very far by just one kind of profession acting by themselves. Some of the professions with the least lengthy training, I almost said the least pompous ones, have been faster in picking this up. The police, who set up what was originally the Strathclyde and is now a Scotland-wide violence reduction unit, that you may have seen in the press from time to time and on your television screens, recognised from the start that police cannot stop violence, that they can only make progress on this problem, which is a very serious one in Scotland, working with the communities in which they operate, working with community leaders, working with the professions in other services, the health service, the social workers, the youth leaders and teachers, and mobilising them collectively to join forces on this. There are fire services which spend more money going around knocking on doors and helping to prevent fires by advising you about fire hazards in your home and screwing smoke alarms into your ceiling than they spend on putting fires out. That's, you know, another kind of community-based strategy of co-production of the service of fire reduction and control. If some of our cleansing departments and parks departments spent more money teaching people to not to drop litter than they spend in picking it up, our parks would be nicer places to be in. You know, we've got a lot of progress to make in this kind of direction. So will the development of advocacy work in that collective co-production direction, or will it fail to do that? These three questions, of course, are related. I'll finish by asking, really, what are the implications of those questions and my kind of moral attitudes on the subject for any attempt to evaluate advocacy, to consider how effective it is, how effective the agencies are in providing this service. I would want to ask, Are volunteer advocates continuing to play a strong hand in the development of this service? Do they, play their part as advocates and in other ways help the agencies? Do they serve on the boards of directors? Are they involved in the agency, not just used as cannon fodder? I would want to ask, how far do they and the paid staff get involved in their communities and get out and talk about the work they're doing, the needs of the people they're serving, get to know the people whom they live and work amongst? You can't do this job by coming in by car from the suburbs and working from 9 till 5 and going home again without any contact with the community you're involved in. He said, I think you can do it effectively. We need roots in the community. We need constantly to be educating the communities we live amongst about the needs of the people we're concerned about. What about the users of the service, the clients of advocacy? Do they also play a part? Are there former users of the mental health services or current users on the boards of directors? Do they sit on the panels that interview and recruit staff? Very important that voice be heard when important decisions are made in these agencies. What about group work? I said, if you only do individual advocacy, you forego opportunities for improving the services for everybody. We have indeed in this room two people working with groups in collective advocacy who have enabled people with learning disabilities to get involved in their communities and make contact with the power structure, better contact than most of us ever have. They've been to the Scottish Parliament, not only once. They've met the Minister of Health and talked to her. They meet their MSP and their councillor and their community policeman. They walk the streets with greater confidence and assert their presence in the community, in the bus queues and in the swimming baths and the shopping centres. They talk about how the services they are depending on can be improved for everybody, not only for themselves. They've contributed to education and training of primary care staff in general practice and bus crews. Telling people who man our buses, do remember that there are people who cannot run down the street to catch the bus. You've got to give them time. Remember that some of them will need help getting aboard your bus, that they may need help with handling change and paying their fare, that they may need to be able to sit down safely before you let the clutch in, that they may need to have you shout out the name of the stop if they're to know when to get off. Now, the point that I want to make in giving that kind of example, or examples about teaching people who run general practices how they get dealt with in by GP surgeries, is that which of us would not be grateful to have buses run by people trained in that way? These are not people just demanding more for them. They are people contributing a different perspective on the world from which we can all benefit. And the same goes, for people with physical disabilities in getting buildings, our houses and our universities and offices redesigned to accommodate folk who can't reach plugs at ground level and can't turn ordinary taps or ordinary door handles. We may all of us need that kind of help and be grateful for that kind of building before we're through. So this collective advocacy, does it go on and how effectively? Is it just, to meet for a cup of coffee and a biscuit? Or is it always clear to those coming that they are learning from each other's shared experience and trying to improve services that they care about and working out ways of doing that? Discovering, for example, that if you draw, don't waste time putting your lots of words on bits of paper this size, draw a big poster and take it along to Parliament or to some office. They can't file that away. When you call on them again in a few months' time, you may find it on the office wall. These are important lessons. Going on, how about outreach work? How about the people in the area I know best, travellers there every summer, families whose needs for mental health services are as great as those of other citizens, but who may never have heard of the services available to them, and certainly not have heard of advocacy. How do we reach them? How about homeless people sleeping under the arches? How about returning servicemen who have higher rates of mental illness than most? It is not surprising, if you listen to the morning news, why that should be so. How can we reach them, and should it be direct or through the charities already working with these groups and serving them, the service families? Associations, or the associations concerned about the homeless, and supporting their advocacy. What's going on in that kind of direction? How about the evaluation of the service? This is a very real question, because in the next year or so, these agencies are going to be evaluated independently, and we're discussing, you know, how that should be done. In England and Wales, there's a strong pressure to establish a professional qualification for advocates, which will enable them to register like social workers and doctors and other people, and get struck off if they misbehave, an individual assessment of the advocate. In Scotland, I think rightly, the stress is not on individual advocacy in terms of assessment and registration. It's on the organisation. And the organisation, I believe, needs to be registered and could be struck off and evaluated. And among the questions it should answer are, you know, do you involve service users? Do you involve volunteers? People with no qualifications. Some of our best advocates have no qualifications whatsoever in a paper sense, but have had long years of experience, probably, in doing battle with public services on behalf of members of their own families, a dementing mother, a schizophrenic son, or whatever. And they come with very good experience of how to do battle on behalf of people with these kinds of needs. And they should be involved as part of this service. Of course, if you're running a course and teaching students, you need to evaluate what they learned for the sake of finding out whether you taught anything. But it's right to, you know, say who did best and what should be done about those who failed and how to help them and all the rest. But that's quite different from establishing a register of qualified advocates, you know, stamped on the left buttock or wherever they do it. You know, you are a properly registered and accredited person to perform this profession. I don't think we should get into that kind of thing. But we do need to ask the kinds of questions I've been asking. And finally, let's bear in mind that the things I'm asking for are expensive for a small voluntary agency with a very limited budget. Running a group and supporting it is not something, as I say, that you can do by swanning in and out once a week to a meeting. You've got to be around, you've got to be there, you've got to know the people and be helpful and available to them. And that takes a lot of time and skill and personality characteristics that are important and which many people don't have. And it's expensive. And if you're going to do outreach work, that's going to cost money too, and may generate more work that you've hardly got the resources to do. So what I'm saying has cost implications, and therefore we need to educate the commissioning authorities as well. Because as the commissioning authorities, in a period ahead of us where they're going to be strapped for funds and having to save money, will be tempted to commission, as contracts come up for renewal, the agency that does the job most cheaply. And that's not going to be the agency that does the things I've been talking about. This is all fairly expensive way of dealing with advocacy. And unless the officials and the councillors and the commissioning authorities understand what I've been saying and That means unless people like you do the research and write about it and publicise it and educate your students about it, then we shall get the wrong decisions made when advocacy agencies are you know, recontracted, and it won't be the best service, and we shan't be able to operate in the kinds of ways I'm suggesting. I've probably talked too long. Very grateful to you all for listening.
Well, thanks very much. I'm sure you'd all like to join me in thanking you for everything.